welcome to this Wednesday Hump Day edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. It's baseball playoff time, and we're going to meet a Fargo native, Christopher Crick, who's one of those people who works behind the scenes in the Washington Nationals minor league clubhouse. We'll look forward to that interview, and also later in the show, Cyril Sweetland. He's the executive director of the Norse Hoostfest Association, and we'll preview the event that's popular in Minot. It begins today. Plus, Prairie Beat takes a look at the school bell-to-bell cell phone ban.
Begin Main Street today as Major League Baseball enters the final week of its regular season. And while the Washington Nationals won't be heading to the playoffs this year, we're joined by someone who plays a vital role behind the scenes. Fargo native Chris Crick already has spring training on his mind. He's the Nationals minor league clubhouse and equipment coordinator, and he's based at the team's facility in West Palm Beach, Florida. Chris oversees the minor league clubhouse during spring training and makes sure that all season long, affiliate clubhouses are stocked, organized, and ready for players, staff, and coaches. It's a lot more than laundry and uniforms. He manages the comfort, logistics, and organization that allows players to focus on the game. Chris, welcome to Main Street.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What's your background with baseball?
Well, I played baseball as a youth, and then in 2006, I started as a bat boy with the Red Hawks. Actually, the winter of 2005, I was playing basketball, and two of my teammates were bat boys, and I was like, that's the coolest job in the world, I want to do that. So my dad called, and I ended up getting a job as a bat boy, and kind of that was my foot in the door.
So how old were you at the time?
12 or 13.
Now, you also have some background in Fargo radio. You were a producer at KFGO and at AM 740 The Fan.
Yeah, so that there's a backstory to that too. All my life kind of happened in that year, 2006, 2007. I have a winter birthday, and it's right around Christmas, so like having a birthday party wasn't like a huge option because everybody's out of town on holidays. And my dad asked me what I wanted to do for my birthday, and I said I wanted to go to watch the morning show at Froggy 99.9. And
because that's what all kids want to do on their birthdays.
Correct. And so he set it up, and he woke me up at 5:30 in the morning on my birthday, and I went in there and I did that every year for my birthday for the next 3 years. And then to my 15th birthday, her name was Amphibian. She said, next year, if you want a job, we'll hire you. And started at ESPN 1660 and then ended up moving over to KFGO and AM 740 The Fan.
But your baseball career kept going.
Yeah.
After the bat boy experience, what happened?
Yes. After my second year as a bat boy, the visiting clubhouse manager was relieved of his duties, and I was 14 years old, and I'm like, hey, I'll do it. And they're like, well, you can't really be hired as the guy, but you can help out just because there's legalities and work, the working world. So they're like, follow around the home clubhouse manager, Derek Rice was his name, and if you like it, like, we'll kind of make a role for you.
What did that entail at the FM Redhawks?
The day-to-day is laundry, cleaning the clubhouse, providing the pre and post game meals, which is provided by the organization, but setting them up, serving lots of laundry, setting up batting practice, that type of thing. And I followed him around. I basically job shadowed for a day, and I was hooked, and that took off from there.
How many years?
I started with the Red Hawks. 2006 was my first year. We won the Northern League Championship that year.
You travel with the team?
After I got the clubhouse manager job, yes. I didn't become the head clubhouse manager until I was 21, so there's quite a few years in between. I was the visiting clubhouse manager, but also you're the home assistant, but you're the head visiting guy type of thing. So I worked with the Red Hawks up until 2016, so 10 years with the Red Hawks. I got an interview. I wanted to move on. I love Fargo, love the Red Hawks, but I had bigger goals. So I went to a career fair that the Minnesota Twins put on, and there was a general manager there from the Beloit Snappers, which was at the time the low A affiliate of the Oakland Athletics, and he needed a clubhouse manager. So he was the only one there that really knew what that was, so it kind of worked out. We got in touch, and I got hired by the Beloit Snappers, the low A affiliate of the Oakland Athletics, and I spent 2017 in Beloit, Wisconsin, as the clubhouse manager, my first year in affiliated baseball.
So working behind the scenes, you're in Wisconsin now. You still love the game.
Love it. And now my experience is like I'm getting a taste of affiliated baseball, which is different than independent baseball, because independent baseball is a bunch of players that have been with organizations and are trying to get back with an organization. When I'm in Beloit, all these players are Oakland Athletics players trying to get to the big leagues with the Oakland Athletics. The coaching staff is Oakland Athletics employees. And then throughout the season, coordinators come in. So the pitching coordinator, the hitting coordinator, the field coordinator, the base running coordinator, all that oversee the coaching staffs of the minor leagues, they all come through. The GM, the farm director, they all come through. So I get to meet all these people with the A's. I get to see how a day-to-day is with a minor league affiliate. And I was probably going to tell me if I liked it or not. Nothing changed.
You were in heaven.
You get that first taste and you're like, gosh, I want to keep doing this. Well, when I realized like there's a realization, like I could get to the big leagues, like it just, that's all I wanted to do. So kind of from there on out, that was like, that became the actual goal.
Chris, I remember walking into my first Casper Rockies game when they were a minor league affiliate with the Rockies in Casper, Wyoming. We walked by the bullpen. And there were several, if not all, of the pitchers who were warming up before the game were from the Caribbean, were from mm-hmm. South America. And the coach spoke English. He had an interpreter.
Yeah.
Did a language barrier ever present itself to you as you were working your way up through the system?
When I was younger, yeah, because I didn't understand Spanish at all. But you learn.
On a roster like you were working with, maybe a quarter of the players don't speak English?
Right. Yeah. I mean, especially in the lower levels, because they're still developing all these guys. Most of your roster is made up of Latin American players, whether they're from the Dominican, Cuba, Venezuela, any of those islands. And they don't know a lot of English, right? They come here and they're young. They're all 18 to 23, 24 at the lower levels. And then they are brought in, and each organization has they take English classes a couple days a week, so they're, because they need to learn English, it's just to be able to function
and help them with their career,
right? Exactly. And I need to learn Spanish to be able to communicate with them, so I've done some of the Spanish apps, and really it's just been learning by talking to the guys, listening to conversations. Because if you learn some of the base words, you can kind of pick up the whole conversation. So, yeah, early on it was tough, but I can get by. I'm not going to tell you I'm a Spanish speaking savant, but I can get by.
Your career continued to grow. What happened next?
2018, I came back to Fargo. So 2018, I worked for the Red Hawks again, and then they wanted me back. Whatever, came back, but then my manager, who I had in Beloit in 2017. Called me and said, hey, this next year the A's are hiring the clubhouse managers, so I'd be an Oakland A's employee at this point. And I was like, well, obviously I'm interested. And he's like, I'm gonna be in AA, I want you to be my clubby. I'm like, all right. But I mean, there's still a process, so I still had to apply, I still had to go through the whole process. But having the coaching staff, three of the five coaching or staff members that I had employed, we're going to be in Midland. So having their recommendation basically was like a pretty good foot in. So I interviewed for that and I got hired in the winter of 2018. So then I went to spring training in Mesa, Arizona with the Oakland A's in 2019 to then be the AA clubhouse manager in Midland, Texas, the AA affiliate of the A's in the Texas League. So
we're working our way up in the minors.
Correct.
You're with a good, solid AA affiliate in a place that has a nice stadium and the town supports the team.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you've ever seen Friday Night Lights, Midland, Odessa. I was in Midland. It's a big football town, but in the summer, there's no football. So, we had good crowds. The stadium is, I love that stadium. I want to go back. That was a really good experience, and I learned a lot. You don't know what you don't know. You know, so I had to cook and order pre and post game meals. So I was cooking, I was doing the laundry, I was doing all the clubhouse duties. There were some things that I just wasn't prepared for because I hadn't been to the AA level, and things change. I mean, like starting in AA, you get your bag, you don't touch your bags. You put them on the bus, but when you show up, they're taken off the bus for you. I unpacked everybody's bags. So like there's a lot more detail. It's like for the players, as they go up, they're getting closer. So they start getting those big league treatments. Not as much as it sounds like, but they do start getting some of those things. So like, those are things I enjoy though, taking care of the players. That's the bulk of my job, but like I learned a lot. And at the end of the season, I had improved, but also I was a little like, I could use some work, you know? And it wasn't like a bad thing, just I felt like.
You knew you had some growing.
100%, yeah.
So what's next?
2020, COVID happened. So I'm gonna go back with the A's.
And let's put the time of year in reference. This is when spring training's getting going.
Right.
The full force of COVID is coming on the country.
So 2019, the season ends. I come back here and I worked at Shields part-time. So I did that to fill the gap between seasons. And me and my boss with the A's decided that I was gonna go back to Beloit, which I was actually kind of excited for, just because they found somebody else to go to AA. And to me, like, it doesn't matter. I mean, maybe they thought I was not good enough, which is fine. Like, I knew I had work to do. I was just happy to continue the job, stay with the organization. You never know what can happen. So 2020, flew out to Mesa, Arizona for spring training. And a weekend, I remember sitting at, there's a little bar and grill across from the hotel that we stayed at. And it was on a Wednesday. And we watched them stop NBA games. And I look at the rest of the clubs, I'm like, we're probably next. And the next day, MLB had a meeting with all the organizations. And Friday was like a optional day. And in spring training, especially that time, nothing's optional. Like, you're either there or you're out of a job. So all the players were there. And then a meeting at like 10 a.m. And the clubhouse was empty by noon because they didn't know. So they shut everything down. The clubhouse emptied. We worked Friday, cleaning everything out that was left. And then Saturday, we came in for like a few hours, and then they booked me a flight. And
you were out of work.
Yeah, I flew home that Sunday. Flew back to Beloit, because that's where I was going to be. And I got my car and I drove back to Fargo, because they said, we'll send you guys to your affiliates when the time comes. We're not, like, spring training at that point was going to be no more, no matter what, right? So they're like, in 2 weeks, whatever the deal is, you'll be at your affiliate. Well, a week goes on, and they're like, we don't know. A week goes on, and then finally, I don't remember the exact timeline. It was the middle of April, beginning of May, they shut down the minor league season. No minor league season. And at this point, they're trying to negotiate and figure out logistically for player safety and all that, how they can have a major league season at this point.
Sure.
Which they did end up having, an abbreviated major league season. So I'm back here. Everybody here, as you know, like all the businesses go into COVID protocol, like they're cutting staff, all this. So I come back and I don't really have much of a job.
Do you think you're out of baseball at this point?
At least for the year, because I don't know what's going to happen.
None of us do,
right? And it wasn't just me in baseball. It was the grocery clerk. Like, I mean, the banker. They don't know, right? There were so many unknowns. So I came back. Everything was kind of like shut down. Again, in the off season, I had been working at the radio station, so KFGO needed help, and I ended up working overnights, which I enjoyed. So I worked overnights at KFGO, and then Shields kind of changed their parameters as we started learning more about it, and I went back to Shields, working at the Moorhead Shields, and then the American Association, Fargo Moorhead Redhawks, decided they're going to play an abbreviated season starting on the 4th of July, 60 games. I'm like, that's cool. They called me. Chris Coast, the field manager, calls me. He says, hey, if there's anybody I want in my clubhouse during this time, I need you here. So a little negotiating between Shields and the Redhawks and myself. And I ended up working that COVID year with the Redhawks. We started like July 3rd and ended on Labor Day. So I was back in baseball. I was excited about that. And I didn't know what 2021 was going to bring. We didn't, right? We had no idea. So at this point, I'm talking with the A's, kind of talking with the Redhawks, with my family at the time. It was time for me to not work baseball, which was death-defying to me, right? So I told the A's no, because I was going to go back to Beloit, like we had talked about in 2020, right?
And that had to have been a hard decision.
It was tough.
We're enjoying our conversation with Fargo native Chris Crick. He is the Washington Nationals minor league clubhouse and equipment coordinator. He's based at his team's facility in West Palm Beach. And I have to believe now things are starting to get really interesting for you.
Again, we revisited with my family situation, not working baseball. So 2022, I didn't work baseball at all for the first time in my entire life. And my gosh, was that tough. That was so tough. So I get a couple interviews, apply for some jobs, and then I get a job with the Asheville Tourists, which is the high A affiliate of the Houston Astros in Asheville, North Carolina. And this was a little different for me because the Astros don't bring their affiliate clubbies to spring training. So
you were at Double A, and now you're with a High A league.
And I'm going to a High A affiliate of the Astros. I didn't go to spring training. I packed up my car in March, and I drove across the country to Asheville, North Carolina, where I met the. I got there like a week and a half before the team. Bus rolls up, and here we go. So I spent the summer in Asheville with the Astros, and at this time I'm like, High A is not a bad spot. Asheville is not a stadium's old, a little run down, but like I'm meeting the Astros people like I did the A's people. I'm like, some pretty good people. Like maybe this is the organization. Maybe this is the organization I'm with. Went through a whole season. And then at the end of the season, decided I was going to go back. But also in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't know if this is Asheville's where I want to be. So like I do every other year, I came back home and I worked at Thermo King again. And then a friend of mine who became a friend of mine in Asheville got hired full time by the Fredericksburg Nationals, which is the low A affiliate of the Washington Nationals in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And his boss is also the guy that hires the clubhouse managers. And they were looking for a clubhouse manager. So Alex called me, he's like, hey man, I know you kind of wanted to get out of there. We need a clubby. And I was like, all right, sign me up. So I interviewed with Elliot, and then I interviewed with Carlos Felix, or House as we call him. He's the big league clubhouse manager for the Nationals. So I interview with those two, and I get the job. Load up the car, head out to Fredericksburg, Virginia. Went out to Fredericksburg, and then went down to spring training. So I did spring training in 2024 with the Nationals. During spring training, I'm an employee of the Nationals. During the season, I'm employed by the Fredericksburg affiliate. I'm not employed by the Nationals. But again, I'm working with their players, their staff. I'm meeting all the coordinators. I'm meeting the farm director. Like, all these people come through. Some of the best people I've ever come in contact with in baseball. And I would say that whether I was employed by them now or not. Like, they were just, like, good people. Eddie, our farm director, who's my boss, he came down a few times, and I'm like, Eddie, what do I have to do to be full-time? Because what you have going on here is great. The people are just the best. I'm like, I like what you have going on here. Like, I want to be full-time with you guys. And he got a little smile on his face. He's like, I know. He goes, I don't know what I'll be able to do at the end of the season, but like, let's talk. And maybe he goes, whatever I'm allowed to do is what I'll do. But again, it's all budgeting. It's all. So I was like, all right. And we stayed in touch and ended up going on to win the Carolina League championship with the Fredericksburg Nationals. And then I was elected clubhouse manager of the year in the Carolina League, which is the first time I'd ever received that award.
That's awesome. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. And to me, that was like a feather in my cap a little bit. Like, I was like, okay, like,
I can do this job.
I really can do this, and I need to like pursue this harder than I have been. And I've been pursuing it pretty hard. So the season ends and I get a job in Fredericksburg. My plan at this point is to work the offseason in Fredericksburg and then be back with the Fred Nats in the spring. Like, just keep, stay there until something works out. So I get a job in the off season. I was basically a property service guy, pulled trashes in front of strip malls. And I mean, I was just to have a job is all I was doing. Well, they were going to develop a position. They called me and asked me if I was interested in it. I'm like, yes, anything to be full time. And it was supposed to be a catering position to help with our nutritionist, to like, I would have been in charge of ordering the food for all the affiliates. And he goes, what do you know about ordering? And I'm like, well, in 2019, I did all the cooking and ordering all the food. So like, he's like, no, what do you know about ordering? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, Brandon Darnell is leaving and I want you to interview for this position, which is the position I currently have. I was like, okay. Like, my jaw hit the floor. Like, here we are. I got hired as the minor league clubhouse and equipment coordinator, and I've been full-time now since November. So now that our season is slowly coming to an end, my minor league seasons will be complete. I have some guys that'll be in Arizona for the Arizona Fall League, and then I'll have some guys that will be at the complex in West Palm Beach where I'm stationed, rehabbing, whether they had surgery or those guys are down there, so we take care of them, do their laundry and such. But now my focus shifts to getting ready for spring training. Spring training, it runs, depending on how you look at the dates, middle of February to the end of March. We have all four affiliates, so we have low A, high A, double A, triple A, all those guys, plus our complex league, so that's another roster.
So we're talking 250, 300 baseball players?
Not quite that much. Our number is normally around 185 plus staff, so we're right around pushing 200 or a little more players and staff. I'm responsible for all the equipment. I'm responsible for the laundry. Now, mind you, I have a staff, but like, this is what we're required. This is what we take care of. We set up the fields every day. So that's four fields set up different every day, plus our batting cages set up every day.
Take us into the clubhouse, not from, you know, who's great, who's not, but what's a clubhouse like?
It is probably 75% the reason I do this job. The relationships I've built just from my position, not even being a player and a player. You're competing against the guy, especially in an organization, but you're also with them for 100 plus days out of the summer. I mean, we play 132 games, right? You have no choice. I mean, you don't have to be friends, but you got to be cordial. Well, when you're in a clubhouse all year and you're riding the buses and doing all this, like, you build friendships and relationships. Some of these guys have played in college together or played against each other in college, and it's a brotherhood, I would say. In the Nationals organization, we're family. Family's a big word, and you can sense that.
Chris Crick, he has spring training on his mind already, even though the season now is advancing to the playoffs in the big leagues. He's the Nationals minor league clubhouse and equipment coordinator. He's based at his team's facility in West Palm Beach. It's been a pleasure visiting with you here in Fargo during a little bit of time you have off before things get busy again.
Yeah, it was nice to come up here, see some friends and family, and get to talk to you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Still to come on Main Street, we'll preview Norsk Hoost Fest, which begins today in Minot, and Prairie Beat takes a look at the bell-to-bell cell phone ban in North Dakota schools. That's still ahead on this Wednesday. Stay with us. Main Street continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein and want to welcome Norsk Hoost Fest Association Executive Director Cyril Sweetland to Main Street. Cyril, welcome. You have a lot going on this week in Minot. It's time for the Norsk Hoost Fest.
Well, thanks so much, Craig. It's great to be with you.
Let's give our listeners who have never come to Minot for Norsk Hoost Fest the best introduction and the best invitation you possibly can for someone who really doesn't know.
Well, Norsk Hoost Fest is a Scandinavian celebration that started almost 50 years ago with the idea of how do we keep our heritage and our culture alive by sharing through the generations this idea of where we come from and how, you know, this melting pot of America and Scandinavians and this part of North Dakota are all connected. It started as a simple picnic, but it quickly evolved when an entertainer by the name of Myron Florin came onto the scene. So over those 46 festivals, it has grown into this beautiful conglomeration of authentic Scandinavian experiences, coupled with just wonderful top-tier local and national renowned entertainment. It has held at the North Dakota State Fair Center. And if you've been to this facility, you know the space well. But when you step during this week, these 4 days of the Norsk Hoost Fest, it's transformed. Everywhere you look, everywhere you smell, everything you hear has an intentionality to it. And it's like any other place that you will find anywhere in North Dakota in the fall.
Many festivals change, they evolve. What's new this year for maybe folks who have seen it in years past, but maybe want to come again?
North Coast Fest is rooted in its people. It always has been, and it always will be. And what you find at this festival is this connectedness amongst people. Just visiting a few minutes ago with a couple who, from Norway, who are trying to find Sondre Norheim's grave. Sondre Norheim was an immigrant to Denby, North Dakota, but it was revered and renowned in Norway as being the father of modern day downhill skiing because of his invention, his contributions to the bindings. But he found his way to North Dakota as an immigrant and really lived, you know, an unassuming life. But this idea that his story connects us and connects people from all the way across the globe is just remarkable. Our people are what make this festival so unique. We can talk about heritage, we can talk about decor, we can talk about food, but it's all those things together that create this amazing tapestry that our participants and the people who love this festival come back year and year and year again to participate in.
For people who are unfamiliar with what it means to have Scandinavian heritage, what are some of the ways that they'll be able to engage and then feel part of the festival?
We believe our heritage and our cultural is really about the multi-generational aspect. While we can talk about the Scandinavian history, we all share these common ties of food and music and how the perseverance of how we come to this place. And that's the same story for Scandinavians and for any culture across the world. But I think for folks that may not resonate to the same things that Scandinavians do, what they find at Husfest is this raw element of entertainment and socialization and dancing in the aisles and good food and camaraderie. And I think for me, it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from, it's the social nature of this festival and the way people celebrate together that really makes it special.
So what does one need to do to take part? They come to Minot. What's next?
I think anybody who really wants to love an experience does the research. I've got a wife who just loves to dig into the details and peruse the websites, but I'd encourage anybody who's thinking about coming to Husfest this year just to spend some time on our website. Look at the lineup, look at the entertainment, look at the stage schedules, look at how the food vendors who are coming, you know, think about all these unique demonstration experiences around cultural, artistic things like ski making and rose mulling and tatting, these things that are really rooted in our cultures. And on that site, you'll find just a plethora of unique and amazing things that you'll never find anywhere else, not in any cultural festival in this region, at least. And I think that is the first step to really know what you're going to get yourself into when you arrive here.
What would you say, Cyril, are some of the must-see or must-do events if we're coming? We maybe a little short on time, can't experience it all. What do we need to really take a look at when we're perusing the website?
The thing I'm most excited about this year is a gentleman from the Telemark region where Sondre Norheim came. And he is going to be demonstrating how to make wooden skis the way they did 200 years ago. And I think that is just so fascinating to think about this lost art in a way in which we all can relate woodworking skills to such a really unique and cultural experience.
Are there challenges for you and your colleagues who work year after year, keeping the festival fresh, keeping it relevant, keeping it important in the region?
I think in any world or any work, you try something, you test, you measure, you do it again. And the only challenge we have is that we only get to do this once a year.
You've been around several, I guess, festivals. Do you have any favorite memories from maybe when you first experienced the event?
I think for me, my memories are connected to the way the smells and the sights and the foods remind me of where I come from. You know, we used to eat lutefisk every Christmas dinner on my grandmother's side of the family. And I mean, just to smell it and to see it and to taste, it just takes me back to a time.
So when does it begin?
The Husfest runs Wednesday through Saturday. And the doors open at 9 o'clock and close at 7. And we are just excited to see people here.
What do people tell you who have maybe experienced North Husfest for the very, very first time? And they come to you and say, oh my goodness, it's not what I thought, or this is exactly what I was hoping for. What do they let you know about?
Well, I think the ambiance is special. But beyond that, I think the people that have experience it for the first time are just taken by the food. I think the opportunity to have all these different flavors in one place of things that are either hard to find or you only make for very, very special occasions. That's, I think, the thing that first timers or people who come back year after year synonymously would say is their favorite part of this festival.
What do you think people would say downtown? How important is Norsk Hootsfest to the community?
If you spend time in mine in North Dakota, this Scandinavian culture that it was, I think, really driven by this festival, it's just so intertwined. If you go to the mall, the signage has dollar horses on it. If you go to a business and you see the team names on the walls, they often have some Viking reference to them. There's little businesses that pop up with, you know, Kuslig, which is a Finnish term for cozy. Again, all these things that are part of the DNA of the Minot community, you know, have come through this celebratory experience that we have each fall. And, you know, for Minot, Husfest is synonymous as with Minot as the North Dakota State Fair is with this community. And so it's a really a special event for Minot, North Dakota.
Long-term vision of Husfest would be?
I think for us, we recognize that the next generation participates in culture different than maybe the generation that built this. And for us, we spend a lot of time working and thinking about how do we build programming for young people. So when you come to the festival with kids under the age of 16, they're free. And the best part about kids at the festival is we've built all kinds of programming, scavenger hunts, we've got music, we've got educational experiences. I mean, there is space inside of this building and this festival where kids can find their own version of this festival. And I think for us, that's really at the core of when we talk about heritage, it's multi-generational, and we really are spending our energy and time thinking about how we build this from that multi-generational perspective.
Cyril, tell me about the entertainment in the Great Hall.
Yeah, the Great Hall is where we put our signature entertainment, and we've got a great lineup this year. And so all that information is at husfest.com, and those concerts happen daily. It's a small upcharge for those tickets, but really a great way to see some wonderful folks and some great entertainment that really speaks to who we are as a group of people gathering to celebrate our culture and our heritage.
Cyril Sweetland is the executive director of the Norsk Hootsfest Association. It starts today and goes through the weekend in Minot, North Dakota.
We look forward to seeing everybody here.
Thank you for joining us, Cyril, on Main Street today.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
I'm Ann Olquist.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for joining us this week for Prairie Beat.
Eric Deatherage is usually in the slot, but he's taken a few well-deserved days off, so I'm stepping into the co-host spot for this week. What are we talking about for this episode, Danielle?
Well, Anne, it's been a month since school has started back up again, so kids across the state are no doubt back into those daily routines of getting up and out the door to the bus stop and back into their classes. But this year, they've had one less thing in the classroom with them.
Oh, that's right. No more cell phones. I remember that from covering the legislative session this year.
Absolutely. So speaking of the 2025 legislative session, lawmakers passed and Governor Kelly Armstrong signed a bell-to-bell law that basically outlaws the use of cell phones in schools. And, you know, when that passed, I do admit I kind of raised my eyebrow a little bit, not so much in my personal opinion one way or the other. I just remember thinking, huh, I wonder how that's going to go.
It used to be back when we were kids, it was very play-centered. We had play-centered childhood, and now it's very much phone-centered. And there's a lot to be said about increased anxiety and depression in kids. And what happens then is there's less independence, there's less resilience. They're just struggling as they're turning into young adults here. And so hopefully this law will help that.
So after last week's episode, you and Eric had talked about how people may be struggling with anxiety because of all the screen time. You were talking about adults doom scrolling through all the crazy news that's going on around us. But for kids and teens, what they may be seeing on their phones on such a consistent basis also has wide-reaching impacts as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, this week I spoke to Amber Rudolph. She is the principal at Cheney Middle School in West Fargo. I wanted to talk to someone about, you know, how the kids have been doing keeping those phones put away. I myself have been trying to scroll much less. And when I have downtime, I've been doing things like reading or listening to music, stuff like that. But it's been so revealing to me how hard that actually has been to do, just keeping my phone put away, turned over, shut off, whatever. It really is almost reflexive to just reach for my phone and open an app. I do it without even thinking about it. So I asked her, how are the kids responding to this new law? How are they, you know, doing not being able to have those phones out at any time during the day?
We've been really pleasantly surprised. As of last night, I looked how many, and we logged them. We're trying to keep data on the infractions. At our school specifically, we have had 44 in the first month of school. So it's not too bad. You know, kids know if we hear it, we see it, we take it.
I did read a report from the North Dakota Monitor, Michael Echterling. He talked to some educators and students as well. Schools in Bismarck and Williston are having similar responses from the classroom.
And you know, those are just numbers for sure, and that's promising. Rudolph told me that at Cheney Middle School, they actually implemented their own cell phone restrictions a couple of years ago, where students were only allowed access to their phones during passing time. But now it's just no phones ever, and they're seeing a pretty meaningful shift in behaviors.
We have a way different vibe now going on, and it brings so much joy to my heart. Seeing a simple game like Uno, eighth graders playing Uno, that wouldn't have happened before. Or Monopoly, they're bringing their board games to school. When you walk down the hallway, kids are talking to each other. They're not walking and texting. They're not calling their parents or, you know, whoever they're calling. It's just really a breath of fresh air.
Well, that's great to hear. I mean, and I think there's also been a ton of research by big tech as well that shows that when children have less screen time, you do see a shift in behavior. And I think anecdotally, we see that in our own lives. We've got, you know, two grandchildren in our lives. And, you know, we're fortunate that they're growing up in a small town that makes us really happy. But there is a screen. And mm-hmm. when they are on the screen, they are on the screen. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I, well, I don't know about you. I'm a bit older than you, but we didn't have phones growing up. And I was late to the cell phone game. I mean, I think it was 2008, actually, when I actually got my first cell phone. I held out. I was a Luddite. But you're the parent of small children. I cannot even imagine being the parent of children in 2025 and thinking about screen time.
Yeah. You know, and back to what we were just talking about, too, you know, with phones in school. I didn't have a cell phone either until I moved away to college. And even then, you know, it was one of those Nokia brick phones. I wasn't even texting on it quite yet. Something that's been an issue with kids, though, are things like peer pressure and bullying in schools. That's always been an issue. And so when I talked to Amber Rudolph, she said that the introduction of phones, texting, social media, it only amplified those issues.
It really hit home. We had a situation in the lunchroom a couple of years ago where a student airdrops an inappropriate picture of a classmate, and practically the whole lunchroom saw that picture. It was horrible. You know, we didn't have any control. They weren't on our Wi-Fi. You know, at the time, the students were allowed to have cell phones at lunch. And so it was really hard, just like toothpaste, once it's out, you can't get it back in. It was really hard to mitigate that damage. That girl's social, emotional well-being was really affected. And, like, you know, it probably will be for the rest of her life because of that picture. And so that has helped situations like that.
Oh, my goodness. I cannot even imagine being that poor kid.
I know. And that's a really extreme example for sure. She said a lot of just day-to-day stuff was really overall damaging and distracting as well. Kids trying to keep up Snapchat streaks, texts, DMs, Instagram posts, just like you and I, the stuff that we like to scroll. You know, kids have their own things they feel pressured to stay on top of, too. My kids are still pretty young, so I'm not really dealing with phones quite yet. But I asked her, you know, when is this going to be my reality? When is this going to be a problem that I'm going to be having to deal with? And she said, you know, by the time kids get to be 11, 12 years old, most of them have phones. By first grade, at the latest, they're already starting to feel pressured, like they need to have phones.
I think there's some involvement with the parents as well, right? Because there are safety precautions mm-hmm. that can be built into the phones with parental controls. So a lot of times parents, they want to know. And then they also want to know as well, like, how can I reach my child? Like, how can I make sure that my kids are safe as well? So there's also some incentive on the part of the parents where they want their children to have the phone so they can stay tethered to them.
Absolutely. And Rudolph touched on that, too. She says, you know, she understands how parents want to keep in touch with their kids. But what did you and I do when we wanted to talk to our parents when we were in school? We had to walk down to the office, right, make a phone call. Parents can call into the school, too, and you know, talk to their kids that way. And she also added that all the learners in the West Fargo Public School District use tablets. And they have email and stuff on there that, you know, if they need to send a message, they can certainly do that.
You know, my parents were school teachers, and one of the things that they grappled with, because they started seeing the introduction of cell phones when they were middle school teachers, mm-hmm. and one of their big concerns was that children wouldn't have privacy anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I think we all need privacy, but because of the concerns about bullying, you know, we also want to make sure that there are avenues of communication as well with our children. Like, you know, the poor child in the lunchroom that she just mentioned. So schools are using tablets. Screens are here to stay. The internet is not going anywhere last time I checked. So how are kids being educated about how to use these tools, how to be digitally, I guess, literate, a digital citizen of some kind?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So she did say that learning to use these tools effectively and appropriately is what will help the kids basically learn their way in the world. Their library and tech staff all have standards that they're, you know, trying to reach. And she says this is everyone's responsibility, too, teaching kids to be responsible online.
For example, last year we had the BCI come in and talk about the dangers of sexting. And it's happening in middle school. And kids are victims to sex trafficking and, you know, sending inappropriate pictures and getting their identities stolen off of, even their parents' Facebook.
We should also point out, of course, that just because kids can't use their phones in school, it doesn't eliminate these problems. But Rudolph says it is having a noticeable impact so far. The effects are undeniable. She says she used to get into work in the morning and there would be a long line of parents waiting outside her office to talk about social media issues that their students were having, and it is greatly reduced right now. Overall, she says removing phones from the hallways at Cheney Middle School has been nothing but positive.
Some days I feel like we're giving kids a gift, like the gift of escape. From 8 to 4 at least, they can, it's one less worry. And, you know, sometimes as adults, like, I feel like it's almost freeing. Like, I don't have to be accessible 24 hours a day. I can focus on what I need to focus on, and hopefully we see the benefits of that shift in thinking.
Well, that's a great point. I'm so glad to have this update, Danielle, because I had been wondering about some of the legislation, like this particular piece of legislation getting rid of cell phones in schools. So I'm sure as the school year goes on, we'll hear even more about how the bell-to-bell cell phone ban continues to have an impact on North Dakota schools. Let's get into the rest of the news that's been going on. What do you have on your docket that you and the news team have been working on?
Well, the fall respiratory illness season is upon us. Health officials are encouraging folks to get their flu, COVID, and RSV shots at local public health units, pharmacies, or through their primary care providers. The American Red Cross is also hosting fall blood drives locally to shore up its blood supplies. Things are good now, but we're always just a disaster or two away from a blood shortage. And former Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford was named interim higher ed chancellor earlier this year. The Board of Higher Education has now named him officially to that post, but they're no longer calling that position chancellor. He will now be known as Commissioner of Higher Education.
Headlines keep coming through the Prairie Public Newsroom. Thanks for all those updates, Danielle.
Absolutely, you bet. Be sure to tune into Prairie Public for more news stories, or you can check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
I'm Ann Alquist, pinch hitting for Eric Deatherage this week.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/DakotaPlans. you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
This is Bird Note. Corvids, like crows and jays, are known for scatter hoarding, which sometimes turns into inadvertent gardening, says forest and behavioral ecologist Mario Pesendorfer.
Corvids will take seeds and hide them all over the area, and often they hide more than they need over the winter, and then many stay in the ground and have a chance to turn into small plants.
That's what happened on Santa Cruz Island in Southern California. It's part of Channel Islands National Park, where native shrub oak habitats were largely decimated by grazing livestock. After these animals were removed in the 80s and 90s, Santa Cruz Island regained vegetation faster than its neighbors, thanks to corvids. In a 2017 study, Mario and his colleagues found that the island scrub jays, a species endemic to Santa Cruz, were instrumental to the abundant new growth.
We could show that the jays that are flying around caching the acorns, they played the main role in the recovery of oak habitat on these islands.
Since corvid species are so widespread and naturally inclined to disperse seeds, Mario says native birds could help restoration ecologists regrow forests beyond the Channel Islands, too.
Most people know jays for their intelligence, and I now have the joy of bringing the ecological role of jays closer to people.
Learn more about restoration ecology in the latest season of Bring Birds Back, available in your favorite podcast app. For Bird Note, I'm Jazzy Johnson.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 24th. On this date in 1904, John F. Briggs of Wahpeton was known around the country as Uncle Sam. He was a popular enactor in the Grand Army of the Republic parades and 4th of July celebrations. A veteran of the Civil War, he attended every national GAR convention but two. Mr. Briggs had just returned from Boston, where it was reported. Though he is 86 years old, he is as hale and strong as a man 20 years younger. His long, thick gray hair and beard, surmounted by a white silk hat, made the picture complete. Mr. Briggs' uniform was made by the ladies of the GAR and presented to him on his 80th birthday. It was made entirely of silk. The coat was sky blue, the vest light red, and the trousers white with red and blue stripes. Mr. Briggs was born on the 4th of July, 1818, in New York State. He moved to Wisconsin in 1854, and in 1879 came to Wahpeton to claim a homestead. He was a lifelong farmer. He always marched at the head of the North Dakota representation next to the color bearer. During the parade at the May 1904 encampment in Washington, D.C., a lady drove up alongside in a carriage and invited him to call at the White House. She was Mrs. Roosevelt. When Mr. Briggs called, he was graciously received. Mrs. Roosevelt said she thought she had a right to demand a meeting with Uncle Sam, being the U.S. President's wife. She added, "When you come again, you must be sure to bring Mrs. Briggs." The Minneapolis Tribune said, "John F. Briggs is the only man in all the United States, so far as is known, who can represent the mythical father of this country without makeup by simply donning a costume of the national colors." He led his last GAR march in Toledo, Ohio, at the age of 91. A large portrait of Mr. Briggs in his Uncle Sam uniform can be seen at the Richland County Historical Museum, across the street from Chahinkapa Park in Wahpeton. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
we'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are grateful that you've spent time with us today. Tomorrow on the show, let's get happy, or at least talk about happiness. We'll have our monthly philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And we'll talk about Finland. Is it the world's happiest country? And what can we learn from the Finns? That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.